Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you for being here. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist, and here each week I'll be speaking to a special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences that have shaped their lives. Today I am thrilled to be joined by the world's greatest living explorer, Sir Ranulf Fiennes, or Ran as he likes to be known. Ran has led an extraordinary life, travelling to some of the most remote and dangerous places on Earth. He's climbed Mount Everest, traversed from the North to the South Pole, discovered a lost city, and ran 7 marathons in 7 days in 7 continents. He's cheated death many times and raised millions for charity along the way. We talk about that time when he cut off his own fingertips and how he was nearly cast as James Bond. All that and more coming up on The Travel Diaries. Sir Ranulf Fiennes, welcome to The Travel Diaries.
Thank you, Holly.
People know you as the world's greatest living explorer. So I just have to say, for a podcast called The Travel Diaries, it is such an honour to have you here.
Well, that's very kind. That particular saying from the Guinness book, and the world's greatest living explorer, due to the exploration records we had. So that's the embarrassing title that they gave me back then.
I think it's one to be pretty proud of, no?
Well, travel sort of became, after the army, my method of making a living.
Mm. And speaking of which, there's no doubt a lot of travel to get through. So let's get started with chapter one of your travel diaries. And that's your earliest travel memory.
Well, when I was 1 year old, because my dad was killed in the war 4 months before I got born, and his mum, who was South African, had lost the other son, my uncle, in the First World War. So, aged 80, she wanted to go back to South Africa, where she was born and her parents were. So she took my mum and all my sisters out to South Africa, and I was one. So I don't really remember arriving there, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I do remember the early days on the coast, under Table Mountain, basically. And I remember photographs of the Kruger National Park. So I was really excited. I must have been about 8 by then. And all my 3 elder sisters got taken. And I was told I was too young. So I was left with an aunt on Vergelegen Beach down by Simonstown, the great naval base in South Africa. And I was brought up by my cousin there for about 3 months while the sisters were enjoying the park and looking at all these wild animals. We only had snakes, big spiders, and the Cape monkeys. It was nice, but I've always sort of regretted not getting to see the Kruger National Park. One day, maybe I will.
So you've not been back since?
I've been back to South Africa many times, and on one or two occasions to look at, see if I can find our old house unsuccessfully, but there you go. No, but I love it. I love South Africa, particularly Cape Province.
And are you still in touch with any of your friends from South Africa?
I have a friend called Sibu Sisuvelani from Swaziland, but half South African. And he asked me to go up Everest with him 2005. And initially, because I have vertigo, I said no. But then a bit later, when my late wife died, I just wanted to do anything which would get me out of my misery. Mm. And I thought, vertigo, you know, attack it, confront it. So you think Everest?
Of course you do.
So I got back to Sibu Sisu and I said, he was the first black man ever to get up Everest from Nepal. That's why he's wanting this time to go up from Tibet. And so I said, Sibu, I'll be happy to take up your kind invitation. Unfortunately, the guides don't like people who are in their 60s without full sets of fingers and who've had massive heart attacks. So we had to go out to Quito volcano course, which checks if you're all right at 20,000 feet. So I did all that, and they passed it okay. In 2005, with Sibu Sisu, tried to get up Everest.
And how did that go?
I got a second heart attack at 28,500 feet above sea level, which is within 300 meters in height of the summit.
Oh.
which was unfortunate, and I was very lucky to get out alive. And I wouldn't have done if I hadn't been given by my wife, who made me take pills, because she knew that the heart attack might not like the height. They're called glycerine trinitrate. I swallowed the whole bottle worth because I was panicking that my heart was feeling being torn apart. And where the double bypass had been done up with wire felt like it was being torn apart. So,
and you're on the peak.
You're in the dark. You're holding on to a rope. You've got lots of clothes on. You've got a big gas bottle, oxygen bottle. You've got a mask. And I really panicked. And I then remembered that I'd taken the pills to keep Louise quiet. And to cut a long story short, 3 days later, the doctor got me back down to the base camp. And he said, "Can I see your pills?" So I gave him the bottle. And he said, no, I mean the pills. And I said, "Well, I obviously took the pills." And he said, "Yeah, but there were 80 in there and you're allowed 2 maximum." So it's a Guinness Book of Records. So I did not get up with Tsubusisu. He did, and he got hypoxia and he died on the way down, but he got to the top. And then I tried again 3 years later on the easy side, Nepal, and we passed too many bodies, including a friend of mine who had died the same night 3 years earlier that I had my problem on the Tibetan side, same problem on the Nepal side, and he didn't have the pills, so he died. The next year, 2008, by which time I was an old age pensioner, Tundu, the Sherpa, who sadly was avalanched last year, agreed to take me and got to the top without any problem at all, and I couldn't work out why I'd made such a mess of it twice.
Wow. For somebody who has vertigo, I'm amazed that was one on your checklist.
Well, at the end of it all, I got back to the UK to Kenton Cool, who's an Everest guide, and he said, "Did you lose your vertigo?" And I said, "No, because there are no drops on Everest." So he then said, well, he would, Kenton Cool, show me, much cheaper, it's in the Alps, not the Himalayas. Weekends he would train me. It's called the North Face of the Eiger, 6,000 foot, pretty sheer. And after a lot of training, he did it. But it took us 3 days and nights just to get up this face. And that definitely did check the vertigo. But at the end of it all, I determined never to go up another nasty rock face again.
So you're looking down and you just feel, how do you feel?
You don't look down. That one of the lessons from Kenton Cool, knowing you've got vertigo, is A, don't look down, and B, more important, don't allow yourself to think down. So if you hear the village Grindelwald 6,000 feet below you, the church bells ringing, it sort of makes you think of what's, but you mustn't. So it's a thought control.
And that leads me on to chapter 2 of your travel diaries, and that is the first place that you fell in love with.
I definitely fell in love with South Africa. I still love it. I know it's got its problems, but then most countries in the world have their problems. It's just beautiful scenically, and although I didn't ever get to Kruger National Park, I did go on one holiday with the sisters and all that lot. To the east, it's called the Garden Route, and I would advise it to anyone going to South Africa on holiday, get to go along the Garden Route to the east from Cape Town along the coast, past the towns of Allen and George and Assegai Bosch, which is the lowest place in South Africa. Beautiful mossy mountains with little trickling falls coming down them. It's just a fairyland, and you can ski there, you know, on snow, which is unusual. And you can get into the ostrich farm where they have competitions because they have bee honey, and the competitions are tourists go by. Can they lift up the various tins of honey, some of which are £300? And you get free honey if you can lift it. And then you can go on a ride round a special pen on a fast ostrich, as long as you don't keep near where it can kick you like a horse.
Did you do that?
No, I watched it. I didn't actually do it. And yeah, the Garden Route is well worth visiting.
So on to chapter 3. And that is the trip where you learnt the most about yourself.
I think moving forward from the 60s to the 90s, we'd done a great number of polar expeditions, north and south, and other expeditions. But one particular one was because we heard that the Norwegians, our rivals, were trying to do the first crossing ever, unsupported by anything, of the continent of Antarctica. And we're talking round about 1,800 miles. So you're dragging food and fuel, and you need food and fuel when it's minus 50. no outside help whatsoever, hauling 500-pound sledges, which is 190 pounds greater than any previous manhaul, starting from the very edge of the Atlantic side of Antarctica, which is bigger than China and India, without Tesco's en route, crossing all the way to the pole, and then if you're still alive there, the other half down to the Pacific Ocean, and whether or not that was possible. And so that is what we did, and I have to say, things were extremely unpleasant physically, and gangrene and frostbite and your teeth falling out because you're incredibly hungry and your chocolate is frozen stiff. So it was very unpleasant, and I think the most unpleasant expedition that I've ever been on, but scientifically of great interest to that form of science.
And what did you learn about yourself when you were going through that unpleasant experience?
Well, although I had by then done 20 years of Arctic, not Antarctic, travel with the same Dr. Michael Stroud, I, on that expedition, hated him, and he must have hated me. And then it wasn't many years after that, I was down there again solo against Norwegians, when I learnt that I had hated myself. The gangrene and everything else and all the unpleasantness and the crutch rot and piles and all the things that happen to you when you're moving make you want to hate somebody. And if you haven't got Mike to hate, and I have to say, as soon as you get into the tent at night and the cooker's on, you lose your hate. You're back to being friends again. You need the outlet to swear at. The whole point of doing it is that your ability not to give in must be greater than the Norwegians.
So you have them in mind all the time.
That is a huge spur.
Are you competitive?
We've become more and more competitive. Initially, we didn't realise, but then after, back in the mid-70s, I can remember, you know, you look behind you on the way to the North Pole or whatever, and it's the Norwegians, you know, or worse still, you look ahead and they're up there.
During your expeditions, you're consistently in dangerous situations and you push your body to the absolute extreme. The question I imagine people ask you all the time is, do you get fearful? And if you do, how do you handle it so that you can carry on?
On the Eiger, the north face of the Eiger, the Murder Wall, as it's called, I got definitely fearful. You have to look down to see where to put the points in the front of your crampons on your boots into little holes, so you have to look down. Mm. So the rule, don't look down, has to be broken. And I looked down to see where to put my prongs, holding onto little holes, and I saw 5,000 feet below my feet, and I really flipped. That was the time I really got frightened. Falling into a crevasse, your mind is full of how the hell to not fall further and how to get out. There's not any room for the actual fear.
So falling into a frozen bit of ice just didn't faze you in the same way?
One should not go into the Arctic Ocean by yourself, because you're likely to fall through thin ice sooner or later. And if you do, very often, you can't get out because the ice keeps breaking. You know, this happens to people, and it almost happened to me on several occasions, but because there was always one other person, you know, and he's not going to be far away, he's going to pull you out, and you're going to pull him out, because you never go so close that you're both going to fall through the same bit of ice at the same time.
And when you're trekking for days and days and days on end in extreme conditions, what are you thinking about?
You're trying to think about something other than the suffering of the moment. And Dr. Mike Stroud, who I've for the last 28 years been doing these things with, he once managed to transport himself from the unpleasantness of the day by thinking of building for his two young children a Wendy house. And he actually planned every nail and what he would do to build it when he got back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
So along with all of these amazingly successful expeditions and feats, there have been some hairy expeditions as well, including one that ended up with a few less fingertips.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is that there had been failures. One expedition, which was definitely a failure, was I was doing what I've always wanted not to do, which is to solo, either in the Arctic or in the Antarctic, because it's stupid. You're liable to fall in Antarctica into a crevasse and not be able to get yourself out. You're liable in the Arctic to fall through thin ice and not be able to get yourself out. Always take another person with you. The trouble was, that particular year, the Norwegians had managed to reach the North Pole without support, two of them. So the only record up there was solo. So therefore, I was doing it solo, which is stupid. And to cut a long story short, one of my two sledges fell in. I hit the quick release on my haulage harness, like a dog, so that it didn't pull me in down into the water. But, of course, it had everything on it. It was minus 48. It was dark. There was a wind. And very quickly, you're going to die if you don't keep moving, keep your body going. So I had to crawl down these breaking. Everything was on the move. And I tried to get my sledge back. And I had to put my hand in to get the traces out of the water to pull it out. And by the time I got it out onto flat ice again on an ice floe which was moving, my hand had lost all feeling.
Oh, my goodness.
The other hand was quickly getting cold. I was quickly getting cold. On this ice floe in the dark, I had to try and put the tent up with one hand. I managed to get the pole into one of the sleeves of the tent, and then it was just going so quickly I'd have had no hands to start the cooker, and my other hand to pump it to get petrol into the bowl, which you then light. Well, I smelt petrol, so I realised it must be in the bowl. So I then took the cooker away, but half of my inner cheek came with it because it was stuck to the metal. So there was blood all over the place, but it instantly froze. Then when I lit it, I had got petrol in the bowl, but too much, not too little. So there was a tent fire in the hovel bit of the tent, so I had to use the sleeping bag, which I'd got. Feathers everywhere, of course, because of the burnt.
I mean, it was funny.
That was my worst moment ever.
So you caught frostbite on your left hand.
Only the left hand. But in the UK, probably anywhere, they won't operate on a thing like fingers or toes until 5 months after the damage.
Right.
So on the farm on Exmoor, you know, I was wandering around with mummified finger ends sticking out. And every time you touch something, it's sort of agony. And after, not 5 months, but 2 months, I was getting really irritable, my late wife told me. And she said, well, she farms, you know, Aberdeen Angus cattle, and with clippers she does their hooves.
Yeah.
And she said, well, why don't you do that? So we bought a Black & Decker bench, rather than wait another 3 months, and a fret saw, and she bought me cups of tea, and the thumb took 2 days.
So just to be clear, you took the sword to your thumb to perform your own self-amputation, is
yeah,
that right?
Rather than... Well, I wasn't going to pay £6,000, obviously, but the insurance would pay if we did it when the doctor said...
You've got the Black and Decker table out. You've got the saw in... Have you got the saw in one hand and your other hand is on?
You've got the damaged bit and you're going like that, and then you turn it round and go like that.
So Rana's just showing me how he's going around his very neatly sawn fingers.
Thank you.
round in a circle, just doing it bit by bit. And the pain, what was that like?
No, Ginny explained with the cattle that if when she's clipping them with the big clippers and they're in a crush thing, if there's any blood or pain, you just move it further away from the live bit. So if there's any blood or pain, I moved it further away.
Has it caused you any problems kind of moving forward with your exploration?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, they wouldn't take me up Everest for the various reasons, and one of which was that I only had one fully active hand.
Frustrating, but I guess in the grand scheme of things, it was...
Well, it was just lucky. It could have been the whole hand. You know?
Or your right hand as well.
Or the right hand, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. I must move on to chapter 4, even though there is so much to cover, and that is your all-time favourite destination.
I think my all-time favourite destination was the island of Rum, R-H-U-M, off the northwest coast of Scotland, where in the sort of 1970-74 period when I got married to my late wife, we used to go on holidays up there because she, when we married, had been working for the Scottish National Trust, taking tourists up Leagach and Sleoch and other Scottish mountains around there. So she knew it very well. And we used to go in a little rubber boat with a seagull outboard to the islands off the northwest coast, and it was just wonderful.
What was it like? What does it look like there?
Totally wild. You've got lots of wild animals, red deer herds and so on, even on the islands. There was one place which was very interesting called the Corryvreckan Whirlpool, where if you're there at the wrong time, it can be quite dangerous, and boats of locals taking their sheep from island to island have found their boat being sucked into the whirlpool at the worst period and have had to throw animals overboard to lighten their boat to get out of the... That's the story. Whether it's true or not, you'd have to ask someone up there.
How about a favourite city?
I think a favourite city would probably be Muscat in the Oman. Second would be parts of London.
Isn't it interesting how Muscat has become such a travel trend, a popular place for people to go now? Have you been back since it's become very touristy?
Yeah, no, I was lucky to be asked back by the Sultan who's there at the moment, Qaboos, although I worked for his father, who he chucked out. But Qaboos is just a great bloke. He's actually sponsored one of our polar expeditions. So we flew the Omani flag at the pole, sort of in gratitude. And I love Muscat. I love Matra.
And how about London? Where do you like to hang out in London?
In the sort of near to where I go running around the Serpentine. As long as you naturally choose the right time of day and not on a day when the sort of guards, the horse guards are going up and down and the police are stopping the traffic.
Speaking of running, you saw a lot of the world very quickly when you ran 7 marathons in 7 days in 7 continents. For the listeners, these were in Patagonia, the Falkland Islands, Sydney, Singapore, London, Cairo, and New York City. How is that even logistically possible?
Thanks to a lady in North London who looked after the British Airways computer. They said if you do it west to east instead of east to west, you gain 24 hours Monday, Tuesday on the dateline. And everything worked very well. And then I got a massive heart attack and double bypass. And my late wife said, Ran, you're not doing those 7 marathons with Mike. And I said, well, you know, and she said, I'm going to take you to the cardiologist in Bristol NHS who did the operation.
This was how long after?
Well, it was 3.5 months to do the marathons after the double bypass. And I've been tied up with wire like they do, you know, when they've put you back together again. And so we went to see him. And he, Angelini, who's still there, wonderful guy, said to Jenny, well, I've done what I've done to your husband, cut him open and done his bypasses to 3,000 other people, but none of them after it have ever asked if they can run a marathon. So I don't have an opinion, which did not help Jenny. And so after about a month, I could walk for 5 miles without lying down all the time. And after 3 months, I could do it in 5.5 hours, which is very slow. And so we did it. And by the time we got to the Singapore one, I just collapsed and went into an ambulance on a drip. And I said, I'm not going to run anymore, but Dr. Stroud will carry on. And if one of us does it, it's successful. We knew we'd get nearly £3 million for that particular charity, Marie Curie. When Mike arrived at the finishing post and he was told that I'd dropped out, he said, oh, has he? He came into the ambulance and he said, Ryan, you are not dropping out. And he gave me these pills. And within an hour, I felt much better.
What magic pills?
I know. I've asked him since and he won't say.
What a feat. What an absolute feat. Right, Ran, so that leads us on to chapter 5, and that's your hidden gem. Tell me about an amazing place that you've been to that our listeners might not know about.
It's not hidden anymore because my late wife and I discovered it, but it had been hidden for a couple of thousand years, and it's called Shisser in the Nejd Desert, which is between the jungles of Dhofar and the rest of Arabia, right the way up to Saudi Arabia, which is sand, basically. It was a place, a Quranic version of what in the Bible is Sodom. I don't think Sodom actually did exist, the place that God buried because the people were naughty sort of thing for it. But my late wife spoke good Arabic. She was determined that we would find the lost city of Irem. And 1968 was the first time we looked for it. And 1990, after 8 big expeditions looking for it and not finding it, on the 8th one we did find it in the 90s, and it's now the biggest excavation works in Arabia, basically. And it's a fascinating place.
That's amazing. Chapter 6 is a place that you'd never go back to.
A place I would never go back to would be any of the places where there is a likelihood of foreigners being put in nick for political blackmail purposes, which in Egypt nearly happened to me on a Nile expedition, again in the late 60s. And I just would hate, above all, to shut up in a prison. That's my worst dream. So I wouldn't want to go anywhere where there was a likelihood of that.
Chapter 7 in your travel diaries is your next big adventure.
Well, we've got 4 things lined up. When I say we, I'm talking about Mike Stroud and Anton Baring and the others who've been in our group for over 50 years now. And Sibu Sisu from South Africa is a great disciple of Nelson Mandela and wants to raise money not for what we normally do, Marie Curie in the UK, but for the Nelson Mandela Children's Foundation in Cape Town. Mandela, for 27 years, was locked up in Robben Island. When he looked out of the prison window, you could see Table Mountain on the mainland. And so Sibu thinks to raise money, which he would do, about 3 million rand, to do a walk from Robben Island under the sea to the mainland.
One thing that I wanted to mention is that some people might not know that a completely different adventure could have changed the course of your life, and that was when you were nearly cast as James Bond. How did that come about?
Yeah, I just got married, living up in Scotland, because we had a free cottage because she worked for the National Trust, and we couldn't afford to get down to London, which I wanted to do because the army was looking for the leader of an expedition to do the first water journey in British Columbia, from border with Yukon to United States border. And I wanted to apply at the Ministry of Defence. We could not afford British Rail to get down from Inverness all the way to London and stay down there. So when a postman arrived at the cottage with an offer from the William Morris Actors Agency, they were looking for a new Bond because that one that Cubby Broccoli had was called Lazenby. And he was charging too much for the next Bond. So Broccoli thought, what we'll do is we'll find somebody who does Bond-type things and train them to act, and they won't want too much money.
Right.
And they got 200 people they thought were likely. So I thought, great, the free to down London and a hotel, I'll go to the Ministry of Defence and hopefully get the job. Not Bond, I knew I wouldn't get that. But surprisingly, I got into the last six out of 200 and got to actually going to see Broccoli. So I can remember the night before looking in a mirror, doing a bit of Shakespeare to take it seriously, and went into the room, and there was Broccoli and the director, Guy Hamilton, of the Bond films. And Broccoli, very rude, he looked at Hamilton and he said, "How the hell did you choose this one? He looks like a farmer." Yeah,
I've seen old footage of you. You're incredibly dashing.
Well, that's very kind, but he obviously thought not.
And still are, I should
So add. The other bloke got the job, Roger Moore.
Oh, that bloke, Roger Moore. Do you ever imagine what life would have been like had they actually offered you the part?
No, but I know that if I hadn't done that British Columbian expedition, which had a BBC World About Us film team with us for 3 months, we would never have got going, Ginny and me, on the expedition
front.
Right,
so it was all meant to be.
Yeah,
007 was just not the path for you. So, Ran, your last chapter, chapter 8, and that is, what is at the top of your wish list? Where have you not been, or what would you like to do that you've not done yet?
Well, one of the failures we were talking about earlier on was to cross Antarctica without support, or even to cross it with support, but during the winter, which is forbidden by every country that has a base down there.
So that's next, if you can make it happen.
If we ever got that, yeah, that's big sponsorship.
There's one thing I've been wondering this whole chat, and that is, do you ever just want to go on holiday and chill out?
I would like to be going on a holiday with my wife and daughter. Yeah, the last one we did was to go with a team of Tanzanians to recreate the Livingstone journey up the Zambezi to the day, 150 years after he reached the Victoria Falls, and at the end of it to put up a big brass plaque at the falls to Livingstone, and we arrived at the falls on the exact day 150 years later.
Oh, that's a lovely story.
Holiday.
That does sound like a great holiday. Well, Sir Ranulph Fiennes, those were your travel diaries. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Holly. Cheers.
So there we go, the travel diaries of Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Oh, I honestly could have chatted to Ran for hours. That was just the tip of his travel iceberg. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, then please hit subscribe and leave a review. And I'd love to hear from you. You can also find me on Instagram at Holly Rubenstein. All that's left to say is thank you so much for listening, and I'll speak to you next time. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.